From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's a busy day in politics despite the holiday and the congressional recess. The president, of course, has to pardon at least one turkey ahead of Thanksgiving. No jokes, please. This is the critter, not the people pardons he's recently made. He then flies to Florida for a campaign rally and perhaps contemplates recent court decisions, a federal judge ruling that the White House can't block officials from testifying, a decision the Trump administration is appealing. And the Supreme Court temporarily blocked a congressional subpoena of the president's tax returns, a big win for the president there. Let's bring in NPR's Bobby Allen. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Robin.
So to the federal district court judge ruling, White House counsel Don McGahn has to testify in the impeachment inquiry. And taking some serious swipes at the Trump administration as she did, she wrote, "No one is above the law. Presidents aren't kings." So this would presumably apply to others the president doesn't want to testify, but the Trump administration is appealing. So do you think Democrats now, you know, drawing up articles of impeachment or considering it, are going to wait for the courts?
Well, you know, Adam Schiff has said repeatedly that he doesn't want to play what he calls rope-a-dope, basically have the Trump administration sort of drag this out over the course of many months to stonewall some of these witnesses. So the House impeachment investigators are now writing their report on the impeachment inquiry, regardless of what happens with some of these court battles over subpoenas.
Yeah. And how did the judge support her decision? It was a lengthy ruling, but, what did she cite in the Constitution, for instance?
Yeah, so I was at the hearing last month in Washington when this judge, her name is Ketanji Brown Jackson, heard oral arguments in this case. And, you know, during the hearing, she made her position really clear, Robin. She, you know, hammered Trump administration lawyers with skeptical questions about their position. And their position is top presidential aides should be able to dodge subpoenas from Congress. So yesterday when this decision came out saying, actually, that's not the case, it didn't surprise too many people who were at the hearing because she basically revealed that's how she was going to rule. But look, she says these people were really close to the Trump administration and they might have information that is protected by what's known as executive privilege, right? And because of this, the Trump administration has said we can't risk those secrets being exposed under questioning. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the judge says, you know, wait a minute, that doesn't mean you're allowed to completely blow off a subpoena issued by Congress, right? And she called the White House's argument that Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, shouldn't appear as, quote, fiction. So, you know, she had another line that's really memorable that I'd like to read here. You know, she says, quote, "The primary takeaway from the past 25 years of recorded American history is that presidents are not kings." So simply put, the judge said McGahn must show up for questioning. And if he wants to invoke this executive privilege in response to some questions, fine. Yeah. But the privilege doesn't mean he could blow off the subpoena.
Okay. So we should add, too, that this subpoena from McGahn was actually issued, you know, after the Mueller investigation. Mueller couldn't rule out obstruction of justice on the part of Donald Trump. The subpoena was issued to ask Don McGahn about that, but now they've transferred it over to Ukraine. And just very briefly, what might he add?
So House investigators are really interested in McGahn. As you noted, his name popped up a lot in the Mueller report, I think more than 150 times. The Mueller report, it seems like ancient history now, right? But McGahn is still relevant in this impeachment inquiry because, remember, McGahn told Mueller's team that Trump wanted Mueller fired. And when word got out about that, he says Trump asked him to write a letter saying that Trump actually never asked for Mueller to be fired. He did not do this, and he eventually left the White House. But again, he's really relevant in the impeachment inquiry because House lawmakers see his testimony as being useful to possible articles of impeachment for obstruction of justice. So the House impeachment investigators are not just looking at Ukraine anymore. It's a little more expansive than that.
Yeah. Well, so a blow to the Trump administration there, but a win from the Supreme Court in another case, the temporary blocking of a congressional subpoena of the president's tax records. Now, judge after judge, you remind us, across the country has ruled against Donald Trump in these cases. So here we have the Supreme Court stepping in. It's a temporary blocking, but what do we read there?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, you know, the Supreme Court granting this temporary, and we must underscore temporary stay on the release of Trump's financial records is a short-term victory for the Trump administration, but a very short-term one. So House Democrats would have been thrilled if they could review the president's financial records as they are writing this impeachment inquiry report as we speak right now, but they won't. At least not right away. But Robin, it's important to note that the Supreme Court hasn't agreed to review the lower court's decision saying Trump has to comply with congressional subpoenas to turn over his financial records. If they decide to hear it, that hearing might not be for months from now, right? But if the Supreme Court decides not to take it up, then this hold, this freeze goes away. That means Trump will have to follow the directive of the subpoena and turn over his financial records to the House.
It, very briefly, Bobby, we have about half a minute. It's, are you saying that perhaps the court just wanted to keep it out of the impeachment hearing process?
I wouldn't go that far. Okay. This is pretty, it's pretty common for, you know, the Supreme Court to sort of put something like this on hold. But it's very temporary, and we're not going to know whether or not they're even going to grant review of the lower court's decision. And again, if they decide not to grant review, that means that this subpoena takes effect and Trump's going to be forced to divulge these financial records.
And here's Bobby Allen. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Legal marijuana is a billion-dollar industry in Colorado, and what happens in Washington, D.C. has the power to help the industry there grow or set it back. So some of the biggest players in Colorado's marijuana industry are now preparing to flex their political muscle in next year's U.S. Senate race. Colorado Public Radio's Benta Berkland has more.
Colorado Senator Cory Gardner is seen as one of the most vulnerable Republican incumbents in the country. Democrats haven't chosen their nominee yet, but all eyes are on former two-term Governor John Hickenlooper. If Hickenlooper, who dropped out of the presidential race back in August, is the challenger, many involved in the marijuana industry say their support will likely go to Gardner.
Senator Gardner has stepped up in support of this industry, you know, in a big way.
Andy Williams owns Medicine Man, a marijuana products and consulting business. In recent years, Gardner's been a strong advocate in Congress for the marijuana industry. He's sponsored bills to let states set their own policies and to let banks work with marijuana companies.
You know, he went out on a limb for us, and I'll do the same for him. And I'll do that with any politician, any legislator. If they're going to support our industry, I'm going to support them and vice versa. If they don't support our industry, I'm going to work against them.
Hickenlooper's record on marijuana is mixed. During his time as governor, he signed legislation to regulate the industry, but he also vetoed widely supported measures. One would have added autism to the list of conditions allowed for medical marijuana, and another to let publicly traded companies invest in the state's industry. Yet during Hickenlooper's bid for the White House, he often talked about his changing views. His positions now are similar to Gardner's, and on the presidential debate stage, he touted Colorado's regulations.
We're the first state to legalize marijuana, and we transformed our justice system in the process.
Hickenlooper told Colorado Public Radio he's proud that his administration has set a, quote, gold standard for implementing marijuana legalization that has since been copied by other states. But for many who work closely with the industry, Hickenlooper's recent comments don't erase the past. Democratic Representative Jonathan Singer sponsored a bipartisan bill to set up marijuana tasting rooms. Hickenlooper vetoed it.
My jaw kind of dropped when I saw him really taking credit for legalization in the state of Colorado when, you know, he was opposed to it to begin with. I'll give him credit where credit's due. He could have presented bigger barriers against the industry, but he was not the industry cheerleader that he certainly presented himself to be in front of the American people.
Hickenlooper's successor, Governor Jared Polis, signed those marijuana bills. Rick Ritter is a strategist who helped work on marijuana legalization. He says he's not sure how much this issue will matter to voters, but he does think Senator Gardner's willingness to protect Colorado's pot industry could help him at the margins.
He recognized that the economic benefits in the state and nationally were great, and that this was a way to reach out to younger voters that Republicans have not been able to do.
And says Ritter, most voters won't be aware of Gardner's record on this issue.
The brand of the Republican Party has not been particularly good when it comes to marijuana legalization. Cory Gardner will have to swim upstream against the brand as he runs as a, if you will, a pro-cannabis candidate.
Gardner's campaign says his position on marijuana is all about states' rights and, quote, doing what's right for Colorado. Gardner says he's glad to have helped broaden the discussion in Congress.
And I credit the cannabis industry for reaching out to people and educating members of Congress about what it is and what it is not, and how we need a policy framework to allow it to be safe as well as succeed and flourish.
This industry does not forget when people are good to them.
That's Christy Kelly, the executive director of the Marijuana Industry Group. The group has not historically endorsed candidates, and she's not sure if it will this time. But she says Gardner's work on marijuana in the Senate could pay off for him.
Candidates that have supported the cannabis industry in the past are typically candidates that the cannabis industry wants to support in the future. That, I think, is true, fair, and an accurate statement.
Members of Colorado's marijuana industry say it will likely be months before individuals or groups start spending significant money in the race. But political observers expect once they do, it'll throw yet another interesting dynamic into what's already expected to be one of the country's most high-profile U.S. Senate races next year. For Here and Now, I'm Benta Berkland.
This day of Thanksgiving, the natives gave to me four bows and arrows,
three native headdresses,
two turkey gobblers,
and a pumpkin in a pumpkin patch.
You're listening to a scene from the satirical comedy Thanksgiving Play, written by Native American playwright Larissa Fasthorse. It's about four white people struggling to devise a politically correct school production of the first Thanksgiving for Native American Heritage Month. In this production, which is now playing at the Geffen Theater in Los Angeles, Fasthorse takes head-on, through humor, the mythology that we've all learned, pilgrims and Indians finding peace over a meal. To talk more about her work, we're joined in studio by playwright Larissa Fasthorse. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks.
Okay, so this play ran last fall in New York. It's here in LA, as I said. It's traveling to other parts of the country, and it's been ranked in the American Theater Magazine's annual ranking as the 10 most produced plays in the 2019-2020 season. And yet, you say that in many ways, this is your most depressing success. Why?
Yeah, it is. You know, fortunately, I will say from the top, I love the play.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy with it. And I'm thrilled that so many people are seeing it. And I think it's doing all the things I want it to do. But yeah, I'm Native American. I'm Lakota. And all of my previous plays, almost all of them, had at least one Indigenous actor in it, a character that had to be played, in my opinion, by an Indigenous person. And I was told my plays were uncastable over and over again, even with one half Native American character.
Really?
Yeah, that it just wasn't possible.
And what's the reason that was given?
You know, the reason is that isn't true. The reason is really that people just haven't tried. You know, if you haven't produced anything with Native American actors in the entire history of your theater, which is pretty much every theater I've ever worked in, then you don't know where to go to find the Native actors, and they perhaps have not self-identified to you because they're only able to make a living playing something that they maybe have, you know, parts of other things, like maybe they're part Hispanic, and so they're playing those roles, but they've never admitted they're Indigenous because there hasn't been a role for them. And so, you know, so it kind of goes back and forth. It's the chicken or the egg, you know? You can't find the actors, but you've never had a role for the actor.
That's
and round and round. So I created this play. I said, fine, American theater, here's four white presenting people in one room, talking about contemporary Indigenous issues. And if you can't produce that, we have a different discussion we need to have.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the characters for a moment. Again, the play takes place at an elementary school. An adult cast is producing a play for students. And the director of the play, Logan, hires what she believes is a Native American actor to be their cultural compass throughout the play. And the cast defers to this actor for her guidance, which then is revealed that she's actually white and only plays Native American people when she isn't playing other ethnicities. We have a clip from the play that speaks to this issue. Let's take a listen.
My voice is the most important. You said so.
Because I thought you were Native American.
So non-Native American voices aren't important?
Did you wonder why we were asking your advice on all this stuff?
Because it's devised. But we need a Native American person to do this play. I got a grant. Look, you hired me off my Native American headshot, so that's on you.
I think I actually laughed out loud when I saw the play and she said, I got a grant. You right? have to be Native American. But these characters, they're a certain kind of white person, liberal, perhaps what we call woke. Why was it important for you to tell the stories with these types of characters?
I live in Santa Monica, which I feel like is the epicenter of performative wokeness. But also in the theater field, you know, we are a pretty liberal-leaning group of folks. And lots of really well-meaning white people are in charge of American theater. And although they certainly have given me a career and been lovely to me in so many ways, I feel like that over-striving to do the right thing and not screw up and not make a mistake creates this weird paralysis where real change doesn't actually happen because real change is messy and difficult and has all kinds of mistakes and all kinds of problems and hurts feelings. And then we find our way through it. Performative change, you know, like we want to look like we're changing without really doing anything is a lot easier. And I think we do a lot of that in American theater and in the liberal left in general today.
Yeah, that message really resonates in this play. As I said, I saw it and I was one of the few people of color in the audience.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine who you were writing this for.
Yeah, I'm definitely writing for white people or writing to white people, right? But I do, I will say, you know, it's a satire for sure. And I think you responded to that from what I can tell already. But it's also comedy. And to me, the comedy was sort of a gift, right? To like, I get you, liberal white folks that tend to come to theater, and I welcome everybody else too to come and laugh and have a good time. And I want people to have that communal experience of laughter together. You don't get that anywhere else except in theater, really, in live performance. And I wanted that to happen. But at the same time, you know, there's jokes in that show that are specifically for my people of color, you know, and some are specifically just for the indigenous folks and some are specifically for people of color. And I can always tell where the people of color are because unfortunately, yeah, there's only a few of y'all, right? Yeah. But I can hear them because I'm like, oh, there's your joke. You got it. I know where you all are.
Yeah, yeah. What's been the response to the play? I'm just interested to know after watching this play, what people come up to you and say.
Yeah, you know, it's all over the map. I've always said, you know, if everybody loved my work, I'd be really bummed out because I wouldn't feel like I'm doing my job, right? Because my job is to change both the face of American theater, but also to change audiences. I'm there to get in your head and make you think differently. And I would say the second half of my play happens after you leave, after the lights come up. That's when the whole second half of the play happens, when you have to think about it and question things and wonder, and why do I accept this as truth? Why have I never questioned this?
Yeah. You've been at this for quite a while. I want to talk a little bit about your career. You describe yourself as a translator. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I'm half Lakota and half white. And then I had a hunka, or an adopted family that is white. I felt all those things, those haves and those outside things as outside. And then they felt like detriments and things that were in my way or holding me back. But now, you know, with the advantage of age, I get to look back and realize that those have given me my superpower. My superpower is to translate indigenous culture and experience to a white audience. So I'm able to translate some experiences that they may not have had before and help them see them in a different lens and maybe from the inside in a way that they've never done before, and hopefully create some empathy and some interest in learning.
I read that you grew up during a period when the government attempted to reconcile with indigenous communities. So something really fascinating is that you didn't really learn this problematic narrative that we all know about the pilgrims and the Indians.
Yeah, no, not at all. It's so crazy. I didn't know any of this until I started doing research for the play, because where I grew up in South Dakota, which is a really rural state, we had Thanksgiving was about family and gratitude and mostly harvest. It was kind of a harvest festival. And so there's lots of cornucopias and celebrating harvest. And that made sense. We didn't do any of that pilgrim and Indian stuff. I had no idea about that until I was an adult.
And then, when you learned about it, how did that change or shape your ideas around Thanksgiving?
Oh, my goodness. It's shocking. It's horrifying. And, you know, there's some of the things like that first song that we heard, the clip of at the beginning of this. It seems silly and fun. It's about, you know, first day of Thanksgiving, the natives gave to me, a pumpkin and a pumpkin patch, and then two turkey gobblers, et cetera, et cetera. It seems, you know, that's a song for preschoolers, and it seems innocuous and cute and fun. But think about it. You're telling little teeny toddlers that they should stand there as little white pilgrims and be given everything that the Indians have, up to their headdresses and their homes. Everything should be given to you, and that the Indians are happy about it, and they think it's great, and that in the end, you should have everything. So really what we're doing with a simple, fun little song is we're taking the toddlers of today and making them the appropriators of tomorrow. The hardest thing that I totally empathize with is that for us to really, all of us of all colors and anythings, to acknowledge indigenous culture and history in this nation, we have to acknowledge complicity. And that if you're here, you're on stolen land. However you got here at this moment, I am on stolen land right now. This is not my lands. And that I have to acknowledge my complicity in profiting off of stolen property.
What do you want us to also be thinking about as we enter this Thanksgiving holiday?
You know, I think gratitude could be defined a lot more broadly, as to not just things we have, but I like gratitude. I love a day devoted to gratitude. But then when we have gratitude, we have to think about, like, how do we have those things? And I think it's okay to hold two very different ideas at once, that I'm grateful for my family or my home or my job or whatever that is. And then at the same time hold, well, how did we get this? And what can I do to repay some of the debt that we all owe by profiting off of someone else's stolen land? And what can I do as a human? Maybe all I can do is right now in my capacity is just to learn who those people are and learn how to name them and learn about them and then start going and saying, is there anything I can do to give back? Is there anything you need? Can I be of service in some way? And if, I mean, if our entire country started just with that, knowing whose land you're on, knowing who the original people are, and asking if there was some way to give back, it would change the entire course of the history of this country. We've never had an awareness like that since, you know, 500 years ago when Columbus first stumbled over here.
Playwright Larissa Fasthorse, creator of the satirical comedy Thanksgiving Play, now being performed at the Geffen Theater in Los Angeles. Thank you so much, Larissa.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office is warning travelers this holiday season not to use USB ports at airport charging stations.
When you're out and about, you might have seen a public USB charging station at an airport or shopping center. But be warned, a free charge could end up draining your bank account.
What? It's something called juice jacking. And to explain that ominous PSA, let's bring in Engin Kurta, professor of computer science and director of the Cybersecurity and Privacy Institute at Northeastern University. Professor Kurta, we should say the LA County DA's office says this is just an educational video, but you say you think this can happen. So do we know of people running around with their bank accounts drained?
It is a possible attack. So every time you attach your device to a USB port, there is a chance that people can potentially access your data or install something and compromise your device. But I think the question is, how likely is it? So doing this at a large scale, say at an airport, I think is something we haven't seen before. It could be possible, but there are other things that I think are more likely. I think it becomes an issue if you're traveling in a foreign country and you're a potential target of interest, maybe you're the CEO of a company or a government employee, then I think an attack like that becomes a bit more likely and something to be potentially concerned about.
Well, the fact is now it's out there, you know, so people may even be thinking about doing this that weren't before. So how would that work? I mean, how would plugging your phone into a public charging station allow somebody to get your information?
So there's some assumptions here. When you attach your device to a charging station, one assumption is that you unlock your device or your device is potentially not encrypted. Then you're making it more easy for people to access your data because every time you attach your device to a USB port, there is a chance that there's also a data connection. So they're able to access the data on the device and potentially manipulate it.
Why? What have they done? Have they corrupted the port itself that you're plugging into?
No, that's just the standard. That's the way USB works. For example, when you want to copy data from the phone, you can attach it to your laptop, right, with a USB cable. So it's basically the same principle. So, you know, if it's an untrusted port, there is a chance that somebody is accessing your data when you're attaching it to it.
Because they can access that port.
Exactly.
And we understand, too, that it's even more, you should be more skeptical when you see the cables there.
Right. So I've also heard of potential attacks. There have been papers in the past where people have left USB sticks lying around. So, you know, if you see something that you don't trust, it's never a good idea to insert it into your device because it might actually potentially have a chip or something, or it might have some harmful data that then gets transferred to your phone or to your laptop potentially.
Well, and I guess the reverse of that, is there something you can do to protect yourself? In other words, still use public charging stations, but block somehow that transmission of your data?
Yes, it's actually relatively easy. Well, first thing, people say don't use them, but if you need to use them, it's always a good idea to lock and encrypt your device. And while it's attached, never to unlock it, because then it's easier to access the data and potentially install something as well. Another thing you can do is you can actually buy a cheap cable that blocks the data. So it doesn't have a data connection, it's just power. So you're basically just charging the device, but there's no chance for the attackers to physically access the device.
Oh, good information. So one more thing to think about when you travel and go through airports. Engin Kurda, professor of computer science and director of the Cybersecurity and Privacy Institute at Northeastern University. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Author Erin Morgenstern made a huge splash in 2011 with her debut novel, The Night Circus, her readers falling in love with this dreamlike big top that becomes the playing field for a contest between rival magicians. The Night Circus was a number one bestseller, translated into 37 languages. There's a movie coming from Lionsgate. And 8 years later also comes Erin's new novel, Fans Have Much to Savor Here. In The Starless Sea, we meet Zachary, a grad student who studies video gaming but loves books. As a child, he was tempted to open a mysterious door in a wall and didn't. Then as a young man, he comes across a book that tells that story. What? How did his story get there? And what is this underground world he tumbles into trying to find out, with stories written on flower petals and walls and couches and pillows and lamps for reading? What is this writing? In one sentence, a reference to the video game Dungeon Crawl classic and Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Kubla Khan poem. And who are these people who want to kill Zachary? The Starless Sea is already on the New York Times bestseller list, and Erin Morgenstern joins us. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Boy, 8 years. I'm imagining, 500 pages here? It might have taken 8 years to come up with this world.
And I wrote many of them many times over.
Yeah, well, and there's I was telling you before we got started here, I actually read the book while we were doing reporting in Iceland, which is, of course, how Tolkien crafted his Middle Earth around the Icelandic landscape. And to read something like this that is also otherworldly in that space was incredible.
I love that so much.
Yeah. But where did you find this world?
Oh, this is a place in my head. I am either blessed or cursed by having a lot of imaginary architecture that lives in my brain. And I always start with settings. The circus was the same way. I had this place in my head. And the writing process for me involves a lot of exploring this imaginary space and trying to find the story within it. And so I had this space that felt sort of like an underground library. I'm always a little averse to calling it a library because it doesn't really have librarians. So it is more...
has guardsmen.
It does. Yeah. But it's this library-esque space filled with books that sort of felt like it was a labyrinthine kind of tunneled space where you couldn't really see where each of the hallways went, and maybe you could see a cat peeking around a corner, but I wanted to figure out what the mysteries were behind it and what the story behind the space was.
Well, sure, and that space comes in large part from your imagination, but it comes from centuries of writing about magical spaces, right? I mean, there's a lot that's predictable. There's like a lot of wooden bookcases and overstuffed couches and sort of Harry Potter-esque kind of thing that we think of. But on that, you layer, well, there's not just some doorknobs. There's hundreds of doorknobs of different shapes hanging from ribbons. And there's not just keys. Keys factor into a lot of fairy tales. There's keys everywhere. It feels as if you were both making a space anew, but recalling a space.
Exactly. I really wanted to write something that felt old and new at the same time. I wanted to draw on those sort of very classic fantasy, classic fairy tale inspirations, but also make it my own. And one of the things that helped with that, because I was already working on that idea of exploring what makes a story and different versions of a story and which one is the real one. And then I started pulling in the video game influence, which really helped to kind of give it that layer of something that felt very modern and very new, layered over those classic influences.
Well, talk about that, because we understand you went into sort of a refuge in Western Massachusetts to get away from the Manhattan, you know, and the internet influence. You wanted to be quiet. But you did play and get into video games. Now, people who love books might have just gasped at that notion.
I think, and this is true, I think some of the most interesting storytelling I've experienced in the last few years has been in video game. I think they're doing really interesting things with narrative. And the thing that captured my imagination and the sort of games that I was playing were these big role-playing games where they're very choice-driven. And the choices you make as your player character affect how the story is going to unfold. It affects what's going to happen. Once you make one choice, you've blocked off options of other things that might have happened within the game. And that sort of butterfly effect storytelling is something I find really fascinating from a narrative point of view as a writer, like that you can have all of these possibilities and not just the one possibility, which is kind of interesting for me to layer that influence into a very set structure like a novel where I had to make those firm choices, but I always wanted it to feel like there were other possibilities of other alternate parallel universe versions of the story that could have happened at the same time.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's right there. It's the door not taken. You know, it's all about which door you're going to choose. Which video games, by the way, did you play?
I'm really into Dragon Age, particularly Dragon Age Inquisition and also Skyrim. I like those medieval flavored kind of things. I don't really like shooting games because my aim is bad. I like throwing fireballs at people when it comes down to combat skills. So those sort of things are very all the BioWare games from BioWare Studios tend to be very character driven, and the writing is amazing in them, and those are some of my favorites.
But your book creds are right out there. Not just the fact that Zachary, in opening these doors, he goes down a rabbit hole. I mean, Alice, hello. But you reference the Chronicles of Narnia. You know, he's in the back of his closet, which you refer to as a Narnia closet. Donna Tartt's The Secret History, The Goldfinch, Where the Wild Things Are. Are those shout-outs?
I really just tried to stuff all the things that I like in this book. A lot of the specific titles that are pulled out are just like my personal bookshelf favorites. Like the Little Stranger by Sarah Waters is in there, and The Shadow of the Wind, and books that I didn't want them to feel like, oh, all of these are references to this like type of book that I'm drawing on. Most of them were there just to kind of expand the literary references in the literary world. I wanted it to feel like these were actual books that Zachary or someone else in the world would be reading right now.
Yeah. What has your life been like? Such a huge success was, you know, it's the old burden or blessing.
It is. It's both. It's everything that everyone always told me never happens to debut authors happened to me. So that was a little hard to wrap my head around because I didn't think The Night Circus would be anywhere near as successful as it was. I thought I was writing a strange book that maybe a few strange people would like, and I underestimated the amount of strange people that that book and that world would resonate with. And I love that. But it did put a lot more pressure on me to write something else. And I needed to kind of step back and think about what I wanted to write and try to create my own artificial bubble, because I got to write The Night Circus in a bubble. No one was waiting for it. No one knew who I was. And now I had people waiting for something. But I knew I needed to write it for myself first. And I needed to write something that felt true and felt real and felt genuine to me, and not just write another book for the sake of writing another book. Yeah.
This space that you create is extraordinary, this underground world. Carving shelves for books into rock, or building racks of metal or cabinets of glass and tables for the larger volumes, chairs and pillows for reading and lamps to read by, adding more rooms as needed, round rooms with fires for telling stories out loud, cavernous rooms with excellent acoustics for performing stories. I mean, do you wish you could go there?
Oh, of course. It is sort of my ideal imaginary space. I'm such an introvert. I like those like, quiet spaces, but I want like everything available. I want all the books. And there's something in the book called The Kitchen, which is kind of a dumb waiter that you tell it what you'd like to eat or drink, and it just appears like magic. And it's very much my kind of everyday fantasy space of what like my creature comforts would be. And also with that layer of it is a big expansive space. There is a lot to explore. There is a lot to kind of vary the day-to-day routine.
So you are decidedly in the fantasy and science fiction portion of the bookstore at this point.
I think they still put me in fiction.
Ah.
Though I'm very fantasy-leaning fiction.
Well, but would you ever, you know, for your next book, would you ever want to move entirely into something that had absolutely no mystery or science fiction in it?
Oh, I don't know. I think I like a quality of something that feels a little magical. Even if there were realistic explanations for whatever appears to be magic, I think I like the potential of what you can do on the page. I think the possibilities are endless. I don't have to worry about a special effects budget or anything like that when I'm writing. So I like having that and using that freedom of being able to do anything. So I think I'll probably always lean at least a little bit fantastical and magical, but maybe it'll go on a sliding scale.
Well, and does that mean that when you're walking around your home in Manhattan, for instance, you're looking at a door and saying, that's not just a door. That is a door too, and the whole thing is unfolding.
I think I do think like that all the time. I'm always wondering, like, what's going on? And especially in Manhattan, there's so many little secret hidden things just in the city that you could walk by a door and not know what's behind it. I used to go to all those sort of speakeasy-style bars with the unmarked doorways, and it feels like another world once you go through that door.
Absolutely. Part of what you've captured in your new book, The Starless Sea. Erin Morgenstern, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's here and now. Russia could be out of the next two Olympics if a World Anti-Doping Agency committee has its way. The Compliance Review Committee is recommending that the country be banned from international sports competition for 4 years. Such a ban, if eventually enacted, would mean that Russia could not compete in next year's Summer Olympics in Tokyo and the 2022 Winter Olympics in China. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us from Moscow. And Sarah, what evidence did the committee use to make this recommendation?
Well, this is because Russia, it believes, has failed to comply with a number of things it was supposed to do to end a previous suspension from international competition. And the particular thing it was concerned about and is concerned about is that data that was handed over from the Russians to WADA, to the committee, it says shows signs of being tampered, was neither complete, it says, nor fully authentic. Now, this is data that relates specifically to the period of time when the World Anti-Doping Agency alleges Russia was operating state-sponsored doping. And that particularly covers the period when Russia hosted the Sochi Olympics in 2014, which you'll remember was a massive prestige project for Vladimir Putin. Yep. But when they've been accused, the Russians, of massive doping on a huge scale. So this was supposed to cast a final light on what happened then. But Russia has been very slow to hand over the data. And when it did hand it over, WADA said that that data was not fully authentic, suggesting there were inconsistencies in the information they provided.
The executive committee is expected to vote on this recommended ban next month. And I've read that it actually will be or is expected to be approved. I mean, this could really be a huge blow for Russian teams and athletes, wouldn't it?
It'll be a huge, huge blow, yeah. I mean, these recommendations will see this crisis in Russian sport extending, first of all, in time for another 4 years, but also, I think, more broadly, because it's talking about all international competitions and across all sports, essentially. And people here have been reacting quite strongly. I mean, a lot of the senior sporting officials here talking about this being extremely sad. The head of the Handball Federation here said that this would be, if these sanctions are approved, it would be the murder of the Russian sport, saying that athletes here were hostages, basically sitting and waiting to hear their fate. So there's been a lot of reaction. There's also been some quite patriotic reaction, including coming from the foreign minister here. He again has claimed that Russia's a victim of a campaign against it, saying that Russia's accused of everything all the time. And saying that, you know, that this is kind of language again about defending Russia against baseless claims. So a lot of that. But also, I think a lot of people realizing that this is really serious and that the sanctions that Russia faces are devastating, really, for Russian sport.
Yeah. What does Putin say about all of this?
Well, he hasn't said anything specifically about this today. I think, you know, the Kremlin's kind of hanging back and waiting to see what exactly the final decision will be on December the 9th, because these are recommendations. The committee will consider them and will come to a conclusion. But certainly, you know, I think there's this kind of sense here that Russia officially has tried to paint the problem in sport as the kind of the case of a few bad apples. You know, a couple of people have lost their jobs. The key whistleblower has left the country, the man who was involved in the doping scheme and who then told the world about it. He's gone and he's been painted as a criminal here in Russia. But, you know, there's something really interesting going on as well, because there is a new head of the Russian Anti-Doping Committee. And he's saying, look, there is some serious problems because there are people who were involved at the time, he says, who, judging by the sort of inconsistencies in this information that was handed over, are refusing to reform. He says they need to be purged from the system. He says there's too many people trying to cover up for their past mistakes, and what they're doing is just making the situation even worse. And that clean athletes, those who are genuinely competing properly and fairly, are the ones who are basically suffering for all of this.
It's interesting, that argument of a few bad apples. I mean, what happened in 2016 was actually called one of the most sophisticated doping programs in sports history. You've mentioned how this new leader is taking steps and saying that folks have to be purged. Are there any other steps to clean up its athletic programs?
Well, I mean, there's obviously a huge amount that needs to be done. But I think, you know, the fact that there's this new boss at RUSADA, the Russian anti-doping agency, I think has been a key step. And he's very keen to stress that he has a new team, that they're doing everything now to comply sort of from point zero going forward. And the messages politically are that Russia will have a zero tolerance approach. But I think this man, Yuri Ganus is his name, is really kind of sort of sounding the alarm to Russia, saying, look, we need to wake up. Russian sport needs to wake up. We need to realize that we can't dig the hole any deeper. We need to get out of this pit and realize that yes, there is doping all around the world, but Russia needs to show that it's clean. And, in order to return to the prestigious world of international sports competition, Russia needs to show it's clean. And so that means he's very upset in particular at these people who appear to have tampered with the data. He says the problem is that there's this whole wrong approach. People think that they know better, that their approach is best, he said. But this, what's happened, he says, was predictable. The fact that WADA has objected, has spotted the alterations. And he says that, things need to change. This needs to stop.
Well, as you said, a final ruling is set for December 9th. That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.